Hello and welcome to another edition of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast. This is John Jantz and my guest today is Dan Zarella. He's an award-winning social media scientist at HubSpot and author of four books, including the one we're going to talk about mostly today, The Science of Marketing, When to Tweet, What to Post, How to Blog, and Other Proven Strategies. So welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
So, you know, anytime somebody adds the word science in the title and calls themselves a social media scientist, we have to talk about research methods, right? So tell me a little bit about what you do that takes us over into the arena of science.
So there's actually a number of different research methods that I use for the data in the book. Some of it is survey data, right? Like if there is not a great source of large scale, quote unquote, big data about a certain topic, but I really want to talk about that topic, or what I'm interested in is about, you know, how people think, how people feel about a certain topic, then I'll do surveys or focus groups. Generally speaking, that's not my favorite source of data, though, because people don't always know why they do what they do, and they don't even really know what they do a lot of times, right, depending on how you phrase a survey and all that sort of stuff. But that's a part. Some of the data in the book is based on surveys. Usually I use that as a sort of direction finder. I'll do a survey about some new area that I want to study, and from that I'll find interesting places to look for quantitative data. The rest of the data is of that quantitative sort. So I mostly use APIs, publicly available APIs, to gather large data sets. So for instance, about Twitter, I have several different databases, you know, into the millions and hundreds of millions of rows of tweets. You know, for Facebook, I'll grab, you know, all the posts in the top 10,000 Facebook pages. And so a lot of the data comes from the vast majority of my data comes from publicly available APIs that I just write scripts to grab and stick into a database.
Awesome.
And then there's one other category of data, and that's, you know, when I want to study email data, email is not a really publicly available data source. So, you know, I work at HubSpot. We have customers who do email. I have friends at a company called MailChimp, and they'll lend me some of their data. So there's a few different places where I do use sort of proprietary data sources that I've gotten either from, you know, HubSpot or from another company that's friends of ours.
So I get asked this question a lot, and I think there's a lot of, in fact, I get, you know, which is one of my funnest things to do is to get to go talk to MBA students and college classes about marketing. And you know, a lot of times people will ask me what the most important skill a marketer, you know, needs to have. And I'd love to hear your take on if you have an opinion on that question.
I think the opinion that I have, I think that's most interesting related to that is not necessarily what the most important trait is, because, you know, of all the successful and great marketers that I've seen, have known, you know, a lot of them have various different, we call them in HubSpot superpowers, you know, different, like mine is being a nerd essentially, right? And so, you know, I don't think you need to have necessarily one particular skill to be a great marketer, though I do think, that it is becoming increasingly important for marketers to be both technical and analytical. So, I think the ability to at least do, you know, some cursory HTML, potentially JavaScript, can be very, very helpful to to an online marketer. And then additionally, you should know your way around an Excel spreadsheet. You know, pivot tables shouldn't scare you, at the very least. Clearly, if you can code and stuff like that, that's wonderful, but I don't think everybody needs to do that. I think it's always been important to be able to write and to communicate and to be kind of creative, but I think that more technical and analytical skills are increasing in importance.
Yeah, I think I'm actually, the next book I'm working on is a sales book, actually. And one of the things I talk about is the need for salespeople to be extremely flexible these days. So to have sort of a myriad of skills. And it used to be enough that, you know, the social skill and the going out there and digging up leads and, you know, building relationships, you know, that in many cases used to be enough. And I think that a lot of times now, the marketer or the salesperson that understands technology and that is able to bring that with social skills, I think is actually where we're probably headed is that flexibility to, you know, jump from to be comfortable in a number of settings.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, people get really, really good at certain jobs in certain, you know, abilities when they can blend them with other abilities that are, you know, potentially on the face value, kind of unrelated. So, you know, where I do marketing and I use my programming ability to do research, sort of combining my storytelling and my creative side with my analytical side, that's where, you know, I've found the most success. And I think you're absolutely right. I think sales folks, marketing folks, you know, when we learn to operate with sort of other modalities, I guess, you know, that's when you see awesome things start to happen.
Yeah, it's the engineer that can sell, and that's a dangerous combination.
Yeah, and honestly, that's kind of how I see myself as I'm a storyteller, but I use data to tell my stories. It's kind of how I see my work.
Yeah, and that leads right into the next question I was going to ask is, do you feel that every decision, you know, from a marketing standpoint should be based on numbers?
Generally speaking, usually if you were asking me that question, I would say yes. However, the reality of it is that certain decisions should be ideally based on data that takes a long time to gather, right? So, you know, at HubSpot, we sell a software package to large companies, and that sales process can take, you know, a couple of months. And so, you know, as a marketing team, we look to judge our leads, we look to judge what we're doing. Ideally, we should be looking at the bottom line, the ROI, but that's a month, couple of months out before we start to see, you know, the results on that. So sometimes, you know, you can't move fast enough if you're only using data. And then the other case where I think you want to not necessarily forget about data, but move without it, at least at first, is when you're trying new stuff, right? Because the one thing that data isn't very, very good at doing in a marketing context is identifying new types of content, new kinds of marketing campaigns, things like that. That's the kind of thing that, you know, creative thinking and creative thinking processes can really help with. So with that said, when you do experiment with something new and when you do try something new, use the numbers to back up and to question whether or not it worked. But don't be afraid to do something new just because you don't have data yet.
Yeah, data can only predict if you've got something fed into it, right?
yeah, and a huge part of marketing, especially now, is got to be doing new things, right? And so you need to be creative and flexible and willing to try new things, even if you don't have the data to back it up yet. But watch the data as you launch it and monitor it closely.
So people ask me questions all the time, and so I generally turn to my guests and say, well, I'll see what they say to this. Today, somebody asked me this. What's one online marketing strategy that even savvy business owners or marketers overlook?
You know, lately I've become a huge fan of Pinterest as a sort of social media channel. And I don't know that I would call it overlooked, except, but it doesn't quite get the same, you know, the same play as Twitter or Facebook does. But
right.
traffic from Pinterest converts at an amazing, an alarming rate, really, because Pinterest is such an aspirational site. People are pinning things that they want to do, buy, build, create, cook. They're pinning things that they want. Basically. And so as a company that, especially if you're e-commerce, right? As a company that's selling something, if you're B2C e-commerce, I don't think that there are too many other, you know, social channels where that buying behavior and that buying psychology is in play quite like it is with Pinterest.
Would you say that, and of course you could probably make a case that this would apply eventually to every business, but would you say that that is particularly true if you have a visual product or a visual, something that's a business that is very visual? I mean, it seems to me that those are the businesses that in certain niches, particularly, they're doing really well there.
Yeah. I think in social media in general, companies that have I think all companies can have a visual product. It just takes more work to find the interesting visuals for them. But if your company, if your product, your service lends itself to visuals very easily, then you have a much easier time with social media, not just in Pinterest. I mean, in Facebook also, and Instagram and all these other sites, Tumblr, you know, you're going to have a much better time just because it's easier to produce visual content, which does extremely well in social media. One of my favorite topics though is, so I speak at PubCon regularly, like one or two times a year, and the first day of PubCon is actually master's training, and so it's like an extra day, and there's only a few speakers, and we have much longer periods, and we get to ask questions. It's a lot more of a workshop kind of environment than just a, you know, up on stage sort of environment. And one of my favorite things to do is to, after my presentation, because most of the speakers are also in the audience, so you can ask them questions too, and we can all have a big discussion. And one of my favorite questions to ask the audience is, raise your hand and tell me if you have a what you think is a boring company or a boring client, and let's all brainstorm different interesting ways to make content. And, you know, so some people are better at it than others, but you'll be surprised once you start brainstorming different ways to make stuff, you know, creative out of what's originally a boring, you know, what is quote unquote a boring client or a boring company. You know, there's a surprising amount of stuff you can do.
Well, I'm going to borrow that because I speak at a lot of associations, you know, pest control yep. associations, siding manufacturer associations, and yep. You know, sometimes they really come away, you know, thinking stuff like that. So I'm going to borrow that and let people brainstorm and see.
Yeah, it's really helpful. You know, my wife, Allison Zarella, is like the queen of this. She's a lot better at that than I am for whatever reason. It's just how kind of her brain works. But you could give her any topic and she'll go off for hours on interesting pieces of content you could create about it. But I think a lot of people have that sort of ability. You just kind of got to, you know, challenge them to brainstorm stuff.
So do you, and I didn't prep you for this, so you can tell me this if you don't have one at the ready, but do you have any kind of really telling case studies where data-driven decisions, and I know you share a few in the book, so maybe from the book, where data-driven decisions, you know, really made a difference? I mean, can you illustrate that?
You know, not necessarily specifically off the top of my head. I do know that. So at HubSpot, we, you know, we have a large email list. So we send a bunch of email about our content. One of the findings that I found with email is that the weekends can work very, very well, for sending, email. And so when we experiment with it, sometimes it works amazingly, sometimes it doesn't. But that's the kind of feedback I get on that piece of data quite a bit, is that, you know, I didn't expect this to work, but I tried it, and it worked really, really well for me, right? And I think that's the biggest takeaway with the data, like what I produce, is not, if I tell you that the weekends are good for emailing, it doesn't mean only email on the weekends. It means experiment with emailing on the weekends, because there's a likely chance that you're not at all right now. And so a lot of the, you know, the great examples and the great feedback I hear is about stuff like, you know, I hadn't been doing this, but because of your data, I experimented with it and it worked brilliantly. So now I do it every once in a while, right? Another piece of data that I hear that about is about the 25% of the way through, where I found that links that are put about 25% of the way into a tweet, so sort of in the first quarter of a tweet, actually have a higher click-through rate than links put in the more traditional places at the end of the tweet. And you'll see people experiment with it, and they're like, I don't have a great reason as to why that works, right? Yeah. But, you know, I'll see people experiment with it, or I'll ask people, you know, have you experimented with this? And they'll say, yeah, and it worked. Well, we don't know why necessarily, but it worked.
Huh. You know what's one of the things, and I think this is a principle that you follow a lot of times is, you know, when people, everybody, all the pundits start saying Wednesday morning's the best day to send email, or Tuesday at 9 a.m. is the best day, and it kind of becomes the generally accepted principle, it sure creates some opportunities for, like you said, sending on Sunday, you know, because nobody else is doing it too.
Yeah, I call it contra-competitive timing, and I find it throughout. I talk about it quite a bit in this book and my previous book, but you know, I find it in a lot of different places, because the thing is, when you talk to a marketer and you say, okay, when's the best day to email, or when's the best time to tweet, or what's the best time to talk to somebody on Facebook, the first place that most marketers go in their mind is, okay, let me try to figure out when the most people are on Twitter, or like when Twitter is the most active, or when Facebook is the most active. But then if you take that just a step further, you realize that's backwards, right? You don't necessarily want to speak when the whole room is the loudest. I always tell the story that, like, there's, you know, imagine you're at a party and it's super loud and you can barely hear the person right in front of you. And so you start telling a story, but you have to yell the story, right? Because you can't be heard. But you know how sometimes occasionally crowds just get really quiet for a second. And so, you know, and then suddenly everybody hears this story about how you wet the bed till you were 16 because you're screaming it, right? So that's, I think, kind of how contra-competitive timing can work, because a lot of times you find Twitter, Facebook, email, you know, these different places, that when you publish content on these off-peak times, you're catching people when they're getting bombarded with less other information, right? I get so much email during the week, I don't read very much of it. I have priority inbox, and I probably only even read half of that, right? Yeah. On the weekends, however, I feel so unloved because I get so little email, and I read everything, right? I somehow got myself on some fractional private jet email list somewhere along the lines, and I read that. I'm not going to spend, you know, $30,000 to go from Raleigh to wherever, you know, some little short leg, open leg trip. But I read the emails because I don't get that much email on the weekend. So experimenting with contra-competitive timing, I find has done very well for me and for other people who've read my data.
Well, and I really find, too, it depends on the intent of the message, too. I mean, there are certain types of messages that I'm more likely – a great example, our mutual friend Chris Brogan sends out a Sunday morning email that half the time is just goofy ramble. But I'm more in the mood to read goofy ramble on Sunday morning than I'm going to put up with it on Monday. And I think it's – you know, it has something to do with the context as well.
Yeah, I mean, Monday can be a tough day in general just because people are kind of getting back into the week and they're inundated with work stuff. But yeah, the content type can also play a big part in it.
Yeah, there's another topic that I find fascinating that you cover in the book, combined relevance. You want to kind of lay that out?
Yes. So the best way to explain the concept of combined relevance is to tell a story. And I believe I don't think I told this story in the Science of Marketing book. It was in my third book, Zarella's Hierarchy of Contagiousness, which is a little tiny little book. But years ago, I think it would be 6-7 years ago now, back when digg.com was what Reddit is now, essentially. It was a social news site, and I was experimenting with it, you know, trying different things, seeing what would work. And, you know, I was actually in the shower one day, and I was thinking to myself, what if somebody made a USB absinthe spoon, right? Now, absinthe is, if you're not familiar, it's like this turn-of-the-century alcoholic drink. It's gross. It's awful. I had some in Prague once. It's nasty. It's like 100 million proof, right? And it tastes like anise, so it's like it's terrible. And to make it more palatable, you have to add sugar to it. So they made these fancy slotted spoons back in the Victorian era, and they have all these little designs on them, and it's got a little notch in the handle of the spoon. So you put an absinthe glass down, you put the spoon over it, you put a sugar cube on top of the spoon, and if you're Johnny Depp in the movie From Hell, you light the sugar cube on fire because that's more dangerous looking. But generally what you actually do is you pour cold water over the ice cube till it melts, and it forms what's called the louche in the glass of absinthe. And so I got out of the shower, registered usbabsinthespoon.com, photoshopped the USB drive onto the back of an absinthe spoon. Didn't say what it did, just posted this really cryptic message like, they said we couldn't do it. Like, who said I couldn't do what exactly? And, you know, now tell us why you're cool enough to get one of these testers, one of these USB absinthe spoons. It made the front page of Dig easily. It's probably the easiest piece of content I've ever seen go to the front page of Dig. there was 500 comments in 24 hours. It was covered by all the major gadget blogs, Gizmodo and Gadget. You know, every once in a while, people will do the weirdest gadget segment, weirdest USB gadgets stories, and it'll get included. I got a call from a small town news station that does weirdest gadgets, like a segment. And I had to be like, there is no spoon. This never existed. But the point is, there's a lot of people who are into both gadgets and absinthe, right? And so these are two, like if you picture a Venn diagram, you would immediately think that the circles don't cross, right? Because gadgets and absinthe feel like they couldn't be farther away from each other. But if you look at the people who reacted, apparently there is a big overlap of sort of nerds who are into geeky things and then people who, it's like a steampunk kind of thing, right? They're also into, you know, turn of the century alcohol, and it's kind of making a comeback. And so when they saw this, when somebody who was into both of these things saw this content, they were like, wow, this was made exactly for me because this is two weird interests mixed together. And it's right up my alley. Right. And so that's an interesting tactic that I often recommend to marketers, to use, because when we're marketing to an audience, we have to remember that the audience isn't just interested in what we're trying to sell them. They have other, they're real humans, right? And they have other interests, right? So I'm really into beer, right? So if somebody were to write an article, you know, marketing lessons learned from the world of beer, right? Or, you know, then people would send that article to me a lot of times. Or I'm also really into zombies. And so anytime anybody writes a marketing lessons learned from zombies article, I get sent that a million times because I tell people, audiences, that I'm really into zombies. In fact, I spoke at a conference once, and by the time I got home, somebody had sent me a zombie mad scientist action figure, right? And so as a marketer, we can look at our audience and try to figure out what else are they into, right? What other things, you know, interest them, and how can I blend that seemingly distinct interest with what I'm trying to talk to them about? So like last year, Inbound, at our HubSpot's conference, which comes up, it's like the end of the summer, Cyndi Lauper played. Because we know, you know, the age range of a lot of our customers and a lot of our audience, and Cyndi Lauper fits perfectly into that. And so it's a seemingly distinct interest, but people loved it, right? Because when we blended Cyndi Lauper and inbound marketing, people, they're like, wow, this is made just for me, you know?
Yeah. You know, as I hear you tell that story about absinthe, the only time I've ever seen anybody order that was some folks from Mashable at CES in Las Vegas. So I think you're...
Yeah.
You're right on.
It's become a thing. Here in Las Vegas, there's several places that have like big absinthe collections. I saw a bunch of it in New Orleans. It's becoming trendy now, and it got re-legalized recently. So, you know, it's sort of in the public eye, and it is kind of nerdy.
Yeah. I'm going to stick with my beer too. So,
yeah.
So, another topic you talk about a lot and is one of those that, you know, how especially when social media first came out, there was like all these rules. You know, you couldn't do this and you weren't supposed to do that. And it was all about this. And one of the things you couldn't do was have a call to action or sell in social media. And I've certainly said that, yes, you can gain permission to do that just like you can anywhere. But I'd love to hear your spin with data on that.
So what I think is most interesting about it is that so I never really was a marketer prior to the advent of the web. So I just kind of grew up with the web and social media as a marketer. But it's my understanding that prior to the web, and I've read, you know, books and stuff written by folks who were offline marketers, calls to action were really big back in the day, essentially, right? Like if you want somebody to do something, you have to ask them to do it, or, you know, always be closing in the sales world. And so it seems to me kind of weird that when we made the move to social media, everybody just forgot about that. And suddenly it became, de classe to ask people to do something. And so I've done a bunch of research, most famously on the phrase, please retweet. Please retweet works. It just does. I forget what the numbers are exactly off the top of my head, but tweets that have the phrase, please retweet in them, get a lot more retweets than tweets that do not have that phrase in it, right? It just works. Now, I wouldn't do it all the time, but you know, use it when you think you have something good. If you look at Facebook, Facebook posts that say the word like get more likes. Facebook posts that say the word comment get more comments, and Facebook posts that say the word share get more shares. Asking people to do things is powerful, and that's how people are motivated to do things. And it just seemed silly to me that when we went to social media, we completely forgot about it. And one of my favorite sort of bits of academic research on the subject was done by a researcher out of University of Connecticut named Irving Kirsch, and he mostly studies hypnosis. And he took, say 100 suggestible people, so people who can be hypnotized. And he broke it into 50 and 50. I don't know if the number was actually 100, but just for argument's sake. And he took 50 people and he put them under full hypnotic trance, you know, with the I don't know, however, you know, with the spinny spiral thing or with the pocket watch or whatever. And he gave them a hypnotic trance. And that hypnotic trance suggestion was to take a stack of 30 postcards and mail one back every day for a month. Right. And then the other 50 people, he did not hypnotize. He just asked them nicely, can you please send these back every day for a month? That group, the second group, sent back more postcards. Huh. So social, with at least with suggestible people in lab environments, social requests are just as powerful as hypnotic trances. Right. So it seems really silly to me that you know, we go to social media, we go to Twitter and Facebook, and suddenly, you know, we shouldn't ask for things. And the funny thing is, if you look at a lot of the folks who say, you know, don't sell, don't use calls to action, if you go to their page, they generally have a follow me on Twitter button, which is kind of a call to action, but
yeah, yeah.
I digress.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's funny about some of this too is that, and I think what makes it challenging and why data is so important in a lot of this is that there are things that you will ask people and they say, oh no, I hate those. I would never subscribe to a newsletter because of drop-down box. I hate those things. Right?
And, oh, yeah.
And then we turn around and do it. And so that's why I think sometimes asking people or getting generally accepted opinions will really lead you astray because I've seen it on my side. I get 300 and 400% more opt-in because I use a smart, pop-up box.
Yeah, that's and my experience is exactly the same. I've more than doubled my email subscriptions based on my pop-over box, however you want to call it. And my bounce rate is actually, it's not higher. It might be a tad lower even, right? And that's why when I said at the beginning of the conversation that I'm not a huge, huge fan of survey data because people don't know why they do it or what they do a lot of times, right? And when you ask somebody a question like that, they're telling you the answer that they want to believe about themselves, right? So if you say, are you affected by marketing? Everybody goes, no. Well, then why do you work in marketing, right? And so I've been trying to come up with a great way to do this at presentations, cause I do like social proof experiments and stuff at presentations. And I've been trying to come up with a great example because there's got to be a question where you could ask the audience, raise your hand if whatever. And then just by the number of people that raise their hands, you can tell that obviously people don't answer the right way. The best one I could come up with is raise your hand if you believe you're above average at your job. And about 70 to 80% of people raise their hands.
Yeah, that's great, obviously.
You
mentioned at the beginning of this APIs and some things that people are maybe even going, I don't know what that is. What for the basic person that just wants to know a little more about what's the best data post, how do I get more likes? I mean, some of the things that you talk about, what are some tools that we all ought to have, as either browser extensions or actual apps or services? Do you have a couple you like to recommend?
I do. And so I want to preface that with a sort of caveat here. And so the data that I produce, like in my books and on my webinars and things, is large data sets, right? Like it's millions and millions of rows, and your particular audience might respond the same way. It might not, right? And so I kind of look at marketing science like medical science, where research is done on thousands of subjects and to find the best courses of treatment that work for most people, and doctors apply those in individual cases first. If they work great. If they don't, they try the next one. And so that's kind of how marketing data is. So if you read some of my research, experiment with it, if it doesn't work, that's it's not that you're doing something wrong. It's just that that's how the data works. And so with that in mind, the best data is obviously your own data. So I've actually released a couple of tools that I think are super awesome to produce the kind of reports that I generate on huge data sets, but you can generate on more customizable levels. The first one is tweetcharts.com. And what that allows you to do, if you go to tweetcharts.com, you can put in a username, you can put in a hashtag, you can put just a keyword in, you can even put in a URL, like a domain name or like a full URL, and it will give you a report of a whole bunch of different kind of data. You have to run it to see all the different data, all pie charts and bar graphs and stuff, of that search, that Twitter search. So it'll tell you sentiment and, gender and hashtag and question inclusion, all that kind of awesome stuff, right?
Cool.
The next tool is retweetlab.com. And what that tool does is allows you to put in buddy's account, right? So I can run yours, John, or you can run mine. But basically, if I run my account, it shows me, say, it'll say 90-something% of my tweets don't contain a hashtag, but the tweets that do contain a hashtag get a lot more retweets than the ones that don't. So maybe I should experiment with using hashtags. And there's a bunch of, I forget the actual number, I think there's like 9 or 10 different criteria that tool looks at. But so between those tools, I tried to do my best to take all the analysis that I do sort of custom on large data sets and allow people to do it on their own data more specifically.
Very cool. Well, Dan, thanks so much for taking some time out today. I know that we'll bump into each other in August and in Boston, but I appreciate everything you're doing. And I really, you know, I asked you that question, the most important skill a marketer can have early on. And I really, you know, for a lot of marketers, it is to start getting at least a little more friendly with the numbers, because I do think that a lot of marketers make bad decisions and waste a whole lot of money because they don't even look at the basic stuff of what they're doing.
Yep. Cool. Right. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Dan. Take care. We'll see you out there.